the motion that this House believes that the internet is the greatest force for democratisation in the world. Is that a mistake?
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, honoured guests, and members of the Oxford Union, as we just heard, the motion for this House tonight is that the internet is the greatest force for democratisation in the world today. Before I give you some various and compelling reasons why we think you should all side with proposition, it's my duty to introduce the guests that will speak to you tonight. On second speaker, we have Ronald Deibert. Ronald Deibert is an associate professor of political science at the University of Toronto, the director of Citizen Lab, and an investigator of the Siphon Censorship Circumvention Project on the internet politics. So if you don't believe me when I tell you that it's hard to censor the internet, believe him. The third speaker on proposition is Bo Ang Dung. Bo Ang Dung is the current chairman of the, is the current chairman of the PDP, the oldest opposition group to the current military regime in Myanmar, currently called the State Peace and Development Council. Now, if I've ever heard an example of Orwellian newspeak, that's it. Whether you call it Burma or Myanmar, the regime in Rangoon he opposes is probably one of the only one in the world left that you can still call a junta and get away with it in mixed company. Further, of all the people speaking tonight, he is the only person who currently risks his welfare and his security for the cause of democracy. And I would like to express the heartfelt sentiment that it is an honor to share the stage with him tonight. The last speaker on proposition is Jimmy Wales. I would like to offer a personal thanks to the founder of Wikipedia, the fourth speaker in proposition, for without this cultural and information revolution spurred by Mr. Wales, well, I wouldn't have information on any of the debaters here tonight. I would also like to thank Mr. Wales for providing yet another brass ring for all of us ambitious students, itching to make our mark in the world. It seems that every year the internet provides another digital manifestation of our weight in the world, and Wikipedia is the latest one. Whereas once we had only the goal to aspire to be the number one Google hit under our name, we now have Wikipedia pages to compete with. We have Wikipedia pages with legions of Wiki police with their Wiki pens, you know, telling us if we're relevant or not. You know, and I'd like to say, personally, shame on him for giving us these goals. As someone sharing a name with a once prominent British folk singer, a former Canadian Attorney General, a 19th century restoration leader, and not one, two, three, but four former Canadian politicians, I have to tell you, it's quite tough out there. That doesn't even have to do with the Canadian poultry maker I'm currently in a Google battle with. On opposition, first speaking first, we have Andrew Goodman. If you ever met Andrew personally, you know that right now he's probably thinking he's the smartest person in the room. Also knowing that he's a competitive debater, know that he will say or do anything to get ahead or win a debate. Thirdly, we know that he's a current PPE student at Magdalen College. This confirms that he thinks he's the smartest person in the room. And also, he's the only person speaking tonight here who's less qualified to speak on these issues than I am. Speaking second, we have Professor John Palfrey from Harvard, of the Berkman Center for Internet Studies and Society at Harvard Law, and the principal investigator of the OpenNet Initiative. Presumably, he is here to tell you, in quite specific and technical terms, of the successes of these regimes in censoring the internet. Before he tells you, however, I must warn you all. I grew up in Boston. And there's something you learn in Boston, and that's you can't trust Harvard types at all. Think Goodwill Hunting, okay? Our guy is Canadian. Canadian. Everyone trusts Canadians. Lawrence Benjamin. The third speaker on opposition, we have Robert Amsterdam, the lawyer for Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the former chief of the Russian oil giant Yukos, and the presumptive political challenger of Mr. Putin in Moscow. In 2003, the Russian government imprisoned Khodorkovsky on charges of fraud and tax evasion and dismantled Yukos in auctions that coincidentally delivered significant assets to Kremlin cronies and kleptocrats. Given the government in Moscow's recent dabbles in international nuclear cuisine, I guess you could also say Mr. Amsterdam has put his life on the risk for democracy as well. Speaking fourth, we have Professor Jonathan Zittrain of the Oxford Internet Institute. He's also of Oxford Internet, but he's also from Harvard, so you have to watch out for him as well. Mr. President, these are your guests, and they are most welcome. Now, with the throat clearing out of the way, I'd like to tell you why you should side on proposition. I'm going to talk to you. Firstly, I'm going to give you, in a sense, a philosophy of why we think how we think democratization happens. And then I'm going to tell you why we think that the internet is the greatest force in compelling people to go through these processes. So let's talk about that first. I think rather controversially, I'm going to say that democracy cannot be gifted, it cannot be bargained for, it cannot even be imposed from the outside. It is something that populations have to demand and they have to take. And that part of that, as a corollary, that you have to get people to come on side to do democracy, to believe in democracy, to demand democracy. And that we've actually seen that in no time has a people who have been convinced of the utility of democracy and have unanimously stood up and demanded it, we've never seen a government been able to fight that. What I'm going to tell you today is that the internet is by far the best force in the world at first informing people about the utility of democracy, second, inculcating democratic values and principles within those people, and thirdly, helping the mobilization of democratic forces. So let's first talk to you about the introduction of democratic concepts. Two of the big institutions that democracies rely on in order to function are, as you probably know, freedom of speech and freedom of the press. Now, interestingly, these are two things which are very susceptible to kind of authoritarian regimes clamping down on. What we can show is that if you think about it, all you need is access to the internet, and in a sense, the grip that these regimes have on the freedom of speech and on freedom of the press are less important when you have access to the internet. Now, of course, they're going to say that censorship happens and that it is very effective, and I'm actually going to defer to the more knowledgeable members of my bench who will prove that wrong. Have fun, guys. But more specifically, in addition to just allowing the functioning of institutions of democracy, it also is becoming significantly more difficult for regimes to hide the atrocities that they commit in order to quell democracy. When in Egypt, they go around and beat up people who mobilize for democracy, it's on the internet in a couple hours, right? When in Zimbabwe, officials beat up opposition members, it's on the internet within a couple of hours. Right? I'll take it.
But for instance, if you're a blogger in Syria, if you just post from the walls, you'd be very hard to find. If you're posting on an internet blog or a web cafe, it's very easy for the government of Damascus to come and find you, lock you up, and then talk to you. Doesn't that make it harder to be a resistance fighter within these countries?
That may or may not be true, but first of all, I'd ask you what the utility of writing some slogan on a sidewalk, right? Like, are you really going to be able to get the full mouth argument for democracy and, you know, like, Syria's bad government? Like, that's how much you can fit on the side of a building, Andrew. Or in a blog where you can outline a reasoned and articulate case for why you should do something. The kinds of restrictions they tell you about that don't exist on the message boards, don't exist with the anonymity that the internet can and does provide, and again, that's what they're going to talk to you about. The third thing under this idea of information is just that I think it's present, if you think about it, that democracies just do a better job of taking care of their citizens than non-democratic regimes. And why is this? It is because they kind of have to. It's built into the system. If they don't do it, they get out of power. As Amartya Sen famously said, there has been no functioning democracy that has ever had a famine. I think that these types of things are things that people can become aware of when they are exposed to these types of information in the internet. Secondly, I'd like to talk to you about inculcating democratic values. This one's a little bit tricky, so you're gonna have to come along with me on it. This point is that just the idea of engaging with the internet in and of itself inculcates the kind of values, aside from freedom of speech, that we think are actually very important in establishing democratic traditions. Now, on the one hand, you may be frightened, because if you think back to the beginning ages of the internet in the West, and then you kind of thought about, well, what would happen now? You think about the billions of, you know, GeoSites homepages and Angel Fire sites, and all the diaries that will come up when Indians and Chinese have access to the internet. And I'll tell you that even doing these types of activities is beneficial. Well, the first reason under this is because as long as you have access in a finger, you can participate. There's no restrictions based on the kinds of characteristics that regimes traditionally use to differentiate people. Of course, there is the idea of identification based on ethnicity, based on class, based on religion. But we would tell you that when it's abstracted to the point of just being words on a page, you can't make the same kind of ad hominem personal attacks that you can make when it's a face-to-face confrontation. You can't divide and conquer the same way that countries do time and time again.
I have a question.
Yes.
What do you say to the people of Estonia who last week have been subject to cyber terrorism, where the Russian government has used the internet to go and start attacking their infrastructure.
So the example he gives of a cyber internet attack is somehow more than all the other examples we're telling you about of how it facilitates democracy. That's kind of facile, I think. Like, he's just pointing about one example of terrorism. I'm telling you about how it mobilizes individuals, allows them to experience the internet, and inculcates values. So this idea that the wedges these regimes use to divide people up, to distract them from the fact that their government's oppressing them, tend to be these kind of physical manifestations, these physical traits, which don't come across the internet. And I actually think it's very important that when you interact with someone on the internet, it's much more difficult to do these types of differentiation. Lastly, I'd like to talk to you about this idea of mobilization. One of the classic problems in fighting non-democratic regimes is the collective action problem. It may be true that an entire population wants a democracy, but the first guy to get it is going to get hurt, right? The first guy to get it might die. In fact, he probably will die. The guy sitting in front of the tank in Tiananmen Square is no longer around because he was the first one or because he was the fifth one. What we see is that the lowering of communication barriers has throughout time, and specifically with regards to the internet, enhanced the ability for people to mobilize in a mass movement. We've heard of flash mobs happening in the London Tube. We've also heard of flash riots happening in China for democracy. Because when you have greater access to communicate across barriers, across boundaries, you can get people together much more easily. You can say, let's all show up at a certain time, and then, you know, we might get a couple of us, but the point will be made. The idea is that just mobilizing for democracy becomes much easier when you have the kinds of access to information that you do with access to the internet. Excuse me. Finally, I'd like to ask you one thing. This resolution, in a sense, begs the question of what other forces of democratization are out there, right? It is incumbent on the opposition not only to downplay the internet, but also to provide us some examples or some actual practical areas of other institutions that will do this, or other areas that will do this. Now, as an American, I can tell you that, you know, military interventions don't work very well to install democracies. You know, we've all learned the painful lesson that if a society hasn't come on board to democracy, if they haven't accepted the values of democracy, they haven't demanded democracy, then guns will not be able to do it alone. But what's left? The workings of the UN? The feckless body, which depends on the very authoritarian regimes for legitimacy? Look at the recent election of Zimbabwe to the chair of the United Nations Sustainable Development Program. Sustainable development. Zimbabwe is the leader of sustainable development in the UN. I'll just let that marinate for a second. Look at the election of Sudan, of all countries, to the United Nations Commission on Human Rights, a commission which folded in 2004 due to the inherent hypocrisy of the members on it being the greatest human rights violators in the world. It couldn't sustain itself anymore because it would be like, they'd be sitting across from the table and they'd be like, this is the guy we're trying to put away and he's on this committee. How can we do anything? The UN is completely handicapped in any meaningful way to actually advance democracy. So what we are left with is an apolitical body which just deals with ideas, which is just inherently about the freedom of speech, about being able to publish your ideas. The idea of, you know, restrictions on the press don't apply when the press is a guy in an internet cafe. They're going to talk to you about how we can track him down, but I think that it's actually just his ability to do that is in itself a statement that he has freedom of press. So if you don't want to say that the internet is not the greatest force of democratization, you need to tell us what is, and I just don't see them. There are current problems with access. Yes, there are problems with censorship, and yes, the effects can take an awfully long time to filter out to political change. This is a question of generations, not election cycles. But at the end of the day, we're left with this inherently apolitical body. And except at this time that you don't need, you know, excuse me, except at this time that where it used to be that you needed a printing press to start a democratic revolution, all you need now is a computer with a hand crank, which they're developing, you know, and a modem. Like, this is how simple it's getting to access the internet, and it's only going to be getting easier. So ladies and gentlemen, we are proud to tell you that the internet is the greatest force for democratization, and we are very proud to propose. Thank you.
Strange standing here at the Oxford Union, an institution so well known for
legitimizing ruthless dictators, legitimizing anti-democratic politicians like Chemin, like General Gaddafi of Libya, like the President of Mongolia, and if you looked in your term card in Michaelmas, like Kim Jong-il, hopefully, eventually, ladies and gentlemen. It just feels strange standing in this chamber and saying that actually what the internet does on side of opposition is it often legitimizes ruthless dictators. It often legitimizes autocratic regimes. Because we're not just going to stand up here today and tell you that the internet isn't the only option. What I'm going to stand up here from First Opposition today and tell you is that the internet actually has positive harms, ladies and gentlemen. It actually harms and sets back democracies in transitional nations. This debate's not about Burma necessarily, although I do think that it does fit into this debate. It's not necessarily about repressive regimes in Iran. It's about those countries that are on the way to democratizing that are being stopped from doing so by the governments of those nations through the use of the internet. But ladies and gentlemen, given Alex did me the grace of introducing me in glowing terms, I should also do the same for him. Alexander Campbell is, as you can guess, a Canadian, an American, bar a Canadian university. He came to us from the south side of Boston, making his way out of the project, and I'm sorry. And the world champion. Unfortunately not, you'll have to wait until later to slag me off in your speech. And at the World Championships held over Christmas and New Year, he was ranked as one of the top 10 speakers in the world. So he's a very, very good debater, and we're very, very glad to have him proposing the motion. Having said that, of course, we on the opposition think that Alex and the entirety of the side of the proposition this debate are wrong. And let me tell you three big reasons why they're wrong, and three big ways in which the internet can be used effectively by governments, effectively by sub-state groups, in order, ladies and gentlemen, to negate the spread of democracy. Because we think that's really important. There'll be some gags about Saudi arms trading thrown in there, about Jacques Chirac, but we want to make quite a serious point today, that actually the internet can be a force for bad as well as a force for good. It isn't itself a neutral instrument, but we say that in the crunch areas, in the areas like the UAE, like South Korea, like India, they're the areas where the internet's being used negatively for suppression, ladies and gentlemen. We say that's a problem. And so I'm going to talk to you first of all about how the internet's a weapon in the hands of repressive regimes, why we think that's really important. Secondly, I'm going to tell you why it's a weapon in the hands of sub-state groups. I'm going to talk to you, following on from what Tim told you in a point of information about Estonia and attacks by Russian sub-state groups in Estonia. And thirdly, I'm going to tell you about Alex's hand-cranked computer. I'm going to tell you why the internet in the developing world, in nations that don't necessarily have full democracy, is often a waste of time, a misfocusing of resources. And we think, therefore, that it's quite simply bad, ladies and gentlemen. But first of all, why is it a weapon in the hands of the state? And we say this for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's a really useful tool for targeting. And Alex kind of said, well, you know, some people are going to be in internet cafes and they're going to be publishing on their blogs. We say, yes, that's true, Alex. But what he assumed was that every country has a free and liberal internet, where when you go into an internet cafe, you aren't spied on. Where, for instance, in Burma, a screenshot of your computer is taken every 5 minutes to find out what you're doing. Where in Syria, there's only one internet provider provided by the state, ladies and gentlemen. And what happens if you're Syrian or if you're Egyptian? And you decide you want to publish something maybe defamatory, maybe offensive, maybe just, you know, pro-democracy, ladies and gentlemen. What happens if you're one of the people from one of these nations, if you're a blogger, is that as soon as you publish something, it's very easy to find out where you were. It's very easy, for instance, to track your IP address. It's very easy to find out the internet cafe that you logged on from. And of course, because all internet cafes in Syria have ways of surveilling you, ladies and gentlemen, it's very easy to find out who you are. And unsurprisingly, the Syrian government aren't massively keen on people saying that their regime isn't particularly nice. And so what do? They find you, they lock you up, they torture you. We think that that's not a very effective way, ladies and gentlemen, of spreading democracy. We think that if you were in Germany, if you were scrawling on the Berlin Wall, we think that was an effective way. We think that it did bring about positive results. But we don't think, ladies and gentlemen, when you're targeted by the regime, that you do actually have an effective effect. We think it's a weapon there in their hands. But secondly, it's really important. I'm sure that speakers on my side are going to talk about this more, ladies and gentlemen, because as Alex said, they are the experts on this. We say filtering in these countries is incredibly important as well. Because over the past couple of years, ladies and gentlemen, the number of countries that filter the content you watch on the internet has increased massively. It's increased to about 25 countries around the world. Why is it a problem? It's a problem because all the things that Alex told you about, all of the democracy's really great, guys, that you really love democracy, all of the things that they think they're getting with the internet, they're in fact not. If you log onto the web in China, you can't access Wiki. You get restricted Google search, ladies and gentlemen. We say that's a problem because you're looking at distorted material. You're looking at material that gives you a false impression of what freedom and liberalization is. No, thank you, Alex. And we think that's a problem. But why is it even more of a problem? It's even more of a problem because all of us are funding that. It's even more of a problem because if you're Google, you're doing that voluntarily. You're allowing the Chinese government to voluntarily, you're voluntarily allowing the Chinese government to take off certain searches about, say, Tiananmen Square, about democracy. And we think that's a really big problem. Because Google's this international search engine that has this reputation, I'll take you on this in a minute, Alex. It's an international search engine with a fantastic reputation. But it's not. It's suppressing freedom of information. And it's giving a false impression about that, and that's something that every single Westerner who uses Google as a search is implicitly backing. We think that's a really big problem. Go on, Alex.
But Andrew, when last week someone the face mouse portrait in Tiananmen Square, most of China knew by the end of the day. How can you respond to that?
Well, we say in China there's a gradual process in terms of liberalization of the media, Alex. So we say that the important thing is the Chinese regime in a period of transition is prepared to tolerate certain things, but it's not prepared to sustain other things that things are more prevalent, the things that are more threatening to democracy. And we think that the internet allows them to do that. We say that if there'd been something striking more fundamentally at the heart of the communist regime, we say it probably wouldn't have been allowed to. Well, like, Alex, you know about it, like, you know why that's true. But we say there's a second reason why it's really important as a weapon of the regime. And that's because it's really hard to sanction. If you're Britain, and you're BAE or someone, and you're selling, say, stun batons to the Syrian police, it's reasonably obvious that they're stun batons, that they're going to be used at some point for repression or for torture. Unless, of course, you're Saudi Arabia, in which case, like, we just don't care, we'll sell you pretty much anything else, yeah. But the problem with software, the problem with hardware, is you don't know what it's going to be used for. You can't sanction it. You can't take any form of action. It's not that kind of hard form of oppression. It's a far softer, more important form of oppression. It's the thing that slides under the net when the UN places sanctions on different countries. And we say that's the other big reason. It's because it's a really effective government weapon that skews the view of their population and that Western governments A, condone, and B, can't do anything about. And we think that's a bit of a problem, ladies and gentlemen. We think that's why the internet's a forceful lead in the hands of governments. But it's also a weapon in the hands of sub-state groups. And we look at, say, jihadist websites and trying to undermine democratic transition in the Middle East as an example of this. The internet allows them to coordinate their actions. It allows them, in some senses, to slip under the net and coordinate them against the government. We say that's a problem if it's destabilizing the democratic transition process. But also, we see that sub-state Russian groups in Estonia have been able to disable Estonian public services websites. They tried to disable the emergency phone calling system in Estonia. We're going to say that's a pretty big harm in terms of if you're an Estonian and you're in trouble, ladies and gentlemen. And so we think that it has an effect of striking fundamentally at the heart of government. But it gets even worse. Because on the opposition, we're going to claim to you that fundamentally the internet can affect democratic elections. In Belarus in 2006, which we're not going to claim to you is the most free and fair election ever seen in the Western world, the government, here's a clue, was probably going to win anyway. But what happened on the day of the election? You saw the opposition candidates, and granted, opposition meaning still part of the government, just a slightly less part of the government, ladies and gentlemen. You see the opposition websites being disabled. You see distributed denial of service attacks on them. You see they're actually trying to hinder democracy, actually hindering the election process, ladies and gentlemen. And why is that really? Because in Nigeria, it's really obvious when you stuff ballot boxes. It's really obvious when the margin is 24 million people and there were only 20 million people voting. It's really obvious that way. It's far less obvious if you're subverting it through the internet. It's far less obvious if you're subverting it through mediums like that. Yes, go on.
Of course, you didn't know that they were blocking these websites on that day, so it seems fairly obvious.
I would agree with you as a Western observer, I knew, but if I was a Belarusian voting in an election, if I was trying to get information, which is Alex's laudable, I agree, name, then I wouldn't have been able to get information. The only bit that Alex's case works, or the case of the proposition works, trying to get information about democracy, as soon as you want to try and vote, sorry guys, no information, some Russian hackers have disabled your website. Unlucky. But what's the big final thing in this debate? The final thing is that we think the internet's a massive misfocusing of resources. We don't think we really need another 100,000 Google homepage, 100,000 GeoCities homepages, like devoted to the dancing hamster, ladies and gentlemen. We don't think that's a very good focusing of resources for transitional nations. We think that the world attention at the moment is on the web. Ladies and gentlemen, it's sexy. It's so sexy that Jacques Chirac has come out to endorse it in between embezzling as the mayor of Paris and the president of France, ladies and gentlemen. And we say because it's sexy, it gets the kind of attention that sustainable development projects that actually do lead to democracy don't get. We say that the $100 PC that's being distributed to Rwanda, to Libya, and to Cambodia probably isn't the best thing that you could use $100 for in Rwanda, ladies and gentlemen. We think there are probably better ways, A, to foster democracy, and B, to give some kind of humanitarian aid in post-conflict resolution. So we say it's a bit of a distraction there. But what's the final thought I want to leave you with in this debate? The final thought is this. In this debate, you're probably going to have a lot of talk about censorship, about people skewing information, about filtering. Kim Jong-il doesn't sit down on an evening and go, Google, I think that these pages should be disabled. Robert Mugabe doesn't sit down at the computer and disable bits of GeoCities. Who did? Look around you in the audience. You'll see members of the Oxford Institute, the Oxford Internet Institute, ladies and gentlemen. You'll see stereotyped techies, you'll see stereotyped geeks. Imagine these people if they were Chinese, or if they were Zimbabwean, or if they were in a country where there was a nascent judiciary trying to exercise its power, trying to have free and fair elections, or trying to have a free and fair judicial process. It ain't the judges that do the censoring, it's them. It's the people that you don't really know very much about. It's the people that hide in the background. It's the people who start their Wikipedia business through adult search engines, ladies and gentlemen. And that's why we think that you should side with the opposition. It's a force for evil for governments, it's a force for evil for sub-state groups, and it's a huge waste of resources, ladies and gentlemen. We urge you firmly to side with the opposition in this debate.